Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Rebecca Freire. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Camacho. My registration number is 20010. Silence is golden. Our founders recognized the importance of silence when they created our adversarial system of justice, where an accused is presumed innocent, where the burden of proof is on the government. Silence is an incredibly important part of an adversarial rather than an inquisitorial form of criminal justice. They enshrined that right of silence in the Fifth Amendment to the Bill of Rights. And the drafters of the Colorado Constitution did the same and included a right of silence in the Colorado Constitution. This case presents the question of whether a non-testifying defendant's silence can be used to convict him, because that is what happened in this case. Before I get into the facts, I want to briefly address the standard of review. I think we both agree that in terms of the evidence coming out, in terms of the closing argument, defense counsel didn't make any objections, and so it's reviewable for plain error. I think there was one instance during the first witness when the prosecutor tried to argue at the bench that post-Miranda silence should be something she should be able to bring out, and we objected, and the court sustained that objection. We made a constitutional argument. That came out in rebuttal closing anyways. I'm not sure why we didn't make an objection then, but I think it was an error in the testimony for the court to allow the prosecutor to ask the question, was he Mirandized? Because in the context of all of these previous questions about whether the client had made any statements, the only reasonable inference was that he didn't. And that is an improper inference under the Fifth Amendment.
Counsel, how do you read Salinas versus Texas? You know, some people could read it that there are five votes for a generic overriding principle that there's no due process violation in the prosecution's use of silence, non-custodial silence, I guess, to prove guilt.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there is equally a long line of cases that have upheld the right of silence as not being appropriate for the prosecutor to use as evidence of guilt. I think there's a real distinction in the case law about when a defendant testifies and when a defendant doesn't testify. The right of silence, unlike, say, the right to counsel, which attaches at a formal proceeding, but I think the Court of Appeals Division in Welsh 1 talked about the historical view of the Fifth Amendment. It's been historically interpreted very broadly. It applies in the investigatory stage, in the adjudicatory stage, in civil and criminal proceedings. And so it has a much broader application. And I think when a defendant testifies and waives the right, a Fifth Amendment right of silence, then the defendant can be impeached with anything. They've waived their Fifth Amendment right. They've made that knowing, voluntary decision. But when a defendant has not, when they have exercised that right of silence, that silence is inherently ambiguous, and there is no relevance, if you take the relevance analysis rather than the constitutional analysis, to that silence.
Is relevance, if we were to look at the relevance analysis, is that as substantial a violation of the defendant's rights, say, as a constitutional violation, if the evidence were just irrelevant?
Probably not. Technically, personally, I think so. But I think when you're convicting somebody with irrelevant evidence, that's a wrongful conviction. But I think it's a lower standard of review.
That's right. I was going to say under a plain error standard of review.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a lower standard of review. And I think, obviously, my briefs attack it from a constitutional perspective. A division of this court in the Welsh 1 case decided to do a constitutional analysis. The Supreme Court, in affirming this court's decision, did an evidentiary analysis, and I think that the reason the court did that is because in the district court below, the parties in two separate pretrial hearings made arguments and the court made rulings under the rules of evidence. So the Supreme Court didn't need to even do the constitutional analysis. And so I think that's why it chose not to do it. There were rulings under the rules of evidence. But here we don't have any pretrial rulings because there were no, obviously this wasn't discussed pretrial and counsel didn't make any objections during the trial. But I think it's reversible error because of the pervasiveness of the testimony and the arguments in closing argument. The state argues that this evidence is relevant to rebut the defendant's theory that he didn't know the marijuana was in the car. But there are two Colorado Supreme Court opinions that have specifically rejected that reasoning. In the Quintana case, the Supreme Court said, silence is inherently ambiguous. It is not relevant.
Did it say silence in all circumstances is inherently ambiguous?
No, not in all circumstances. There are exceptions. And when a defendant testifies, that is a huge exception.
Ms. Ferrer, pardon me. And I'd like Mr. Fisher to address this as well. I'm trying to figure out why the Fifth Amendment applies in this particular case when there was no actual police interrogation or interview. Doesn't the Fifth Amendment require some police or state action?
Well, I think there was state action from the moment of the stop. Officer Cutler, Trooper Cutler, stopped this van for a traffic violation. He told both people, only one understood, my client, that there was an improper turn signal violation. And so you have state action from the very beginning. And under the old U.S. Supreme Court cases, which say, you know, this implies, the Fifth Amendment applies to investigatory, adjudicatory proceedings. Clearly, this was an investigatory set of circumstances from the get-go. So I do think that there was government involvement.
Well, how would you distinguish it from the cases, for instance, where someone's doing a drug search in someone's apartment? They're not questioning the defendant. They pull out heroin and someone says, well, that's my wife's, that's not mine. It's not custodial interrogation, so it's not an excludable blurting out of a statement. So why should someone's spontaneously failure to deny that the drugs were in the car, why is that any different?
Well, because there can be a lot of different reasons for someone to remain silent. And I think it goes back to silence is inherently ambiguous. I think if a person says, oh, that belongs to somebody, that's a voluntary statement. If they choose to make a statement, then that statement can be admitted by the prosecutor in its case. This isn't the case of like an adoptive admission. There are some circumstances and the cases, cite cases where adoptive admissions, where statements do come in as adoptive admissions. And they usually involve co-conspirator conversations where somebody doesn't say something or somebody does say something. But those statements are coming into the trial as substantive evidence anyways. But I do think silence is different. The Fifth Amendment gives you the right to silence. The Constitution does, so it is different.
Counsel, let me return to Salinas versus Kansas. Salinas versus Texas, I'm sorry. Salinas is in Kansas. Salinas right. versus Texas. Again, your response to that was, well, there are other cases. Well, those cases preceded Salinas versus Texas. So are those cases good authority? And if they are, or if you think they are, why should they remain good authority?
Well, I think that a lot of the Supreme Court case law, it hasn't been specifically overruled. We've got Doyle, we've got the Griffin case.
But Doyle is actually, you know, you've been Mirandized, and it's
correct.
Unfair to penalize somebody once you've been told that anything you can say will be used against you, and then you remain silent.
Right.
And that rationale is that they misled you by telling you that your silence
correct.
Could be used against you. So Doyle doesn't really come into play, but Salinas versus Texas, I give up, Salinas, that is different.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't specifically said pre-arrest silence is protected by the Fifth Amendment, but they haven't said that it's not protected by the Fifth Amendment. And I think that this court, all right, in the Welsh One opinion, said, yes, it is protected. Pre-arrest silence is. Post-arrest silence, I think the Colorado Supreme Court has said that is irrelevant. That's the Quintana case. I think the Colorado Supreme Court has said pre-arrest silence is irrelevant in the Welsh 2 case. So the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't definitively said that it's protected. But I think if you look at silence in the context of all the cases and the historical interpretation of the Fifth Amendment, when you, even those cases that Jenkins cites, that the circuit court cases that really require some sort of government action to trigger the right to silence, at least in the facts of this case, we have government action from the beginning. And I think that the ambiguity of the silence in this case is really enhanced by three facts. We've got two defendants who don't speak the English language. We have Officer Vasquez, who stood with the defendants, and he told them both to quit talking. He told them, presumably in Spanish, because he was the Spanish-speaking officer, but we have an officer saying, stop talking. And then finally, we have the circumstances of the arrest in this case. Officer Cutler talked about how, well, I found one brick in the door and I put it on the seat, and then we kind of jimmied the door frame apart and we found all these other bricks, and then we went back to where the defendants were standing with our guns pointed at them and put them to the ground and arrested them. Well, I don't think that circumstance, especially when they've been told not to talk, is going to generate a lot of explanation. So I think that the silence generally is inherently ambiguous, but I think it's made even more so by the unique circumstances of this case. And the prosecutor's theme from beginning to end was there are no statements, there are no denials, and there's no emotion. That's what she brought out through all the witnesses. That's what she argued in closing argument. And that violated the right of silence under the Constitution. Silence was used as evidence of Mr. Camacho's guilt. The court doesn't have any more questions. I think I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher, the Attorney General's office, and I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. At the outset of my argument, I'd like to address Judge Dunn's question that she posed to both parties. And it's the people's position the Fifth Amendment does not apply to this case because Miranda was, in fact, not read to the defendant at the time of arrest. Miranda came in later. The record indicates that happened on March 9th. And according to a line of cases, Miranda only, or I should say, the right to silence at that point becomes an issue when the state has basically made a promise to the defendant that his silence not be used against him, and then later at the trial, if the silence is used against him, that's a problem. But that's not the situation in this particular case. Regarding the issue of why, in fact, silence became an issue in Mr. Camacho's trial, I think it's important to get the people's theory out at the open, and that is that the prosecution used the silence in this particular case as anticipatory impeachment of the defendant's chosen line of defense in this case. And there's many facts from the record that would highlight why this is so. First of all, the defendant had Mr. Rojo, the co-defendant, present at trial from either the jail or the prison or wherever he was housed to testify on his behalf. And according to everything in the record, he was going to say, Mr. Camacho knew nothing about the drugs. They were all mine. I'm taking ownership of them. The prosecution in a pretrial motion
said... Did they actually produce that evidence?
Of Mr. Rojo?
Yes.
No, they did not.
So there was no evidence that it was someone else's drugs?
Actually, there was, Your Honor, in the record. There was some brief cross-examination of Trooper Cutler that came out that where he said, and I can cite to the record specifically, on cross-examination, counsel said, did he, Rojo, at the time indicate that they, the drugs, were his drugs? Answer, no, he didn't. And then on cross, he says, that came out later? Trooper Cutler, yeah, I wasn't around when that happened, apparently. I was in court or before they went to court. So in fact, there was evidence in the record where the drugs were assigned to Mr. Rojo and Mr. Camacho was off the hook. Going back to more of why the prosecution believed that this line of defense was going to come in, not only once, but twice in pretrial statements, or I should say, excuse me, in voir dire to the jury, in comments during voir dire, as well as opening statements, the prosecution said, defense counsel said that Mr. Rojo was going to testify, he was going to say the drugs were not his, and that in fact the defendant knew nothing about him. I've already mentioned Trooper Cutler's testimony, and then he also argued that continuing in closing argument as well, saying again, the drugs belonged to Mr. Rojo, my client knew nothing about them.
What happens if there were no evidence presented about that? And there was an anticipatory belief in the prosecution that they would have to elicit that evidence. They elicit that evidence, and then the defense does not elicit evidence that it was Rojo's. Is there a reversible error in that instance?
Your Honor, I would say no. Again, we're looking at this from the aspect of plain error. It's a very high bar for the defense. And according to a division of this court in People versus Davis, in fact, the defense can be bound by the statements of defense counsel as well. Again, I'm quoting from that opinion. It says, these examinations regarding post-arrest silence are permissible because they do not seek to have jurors infer guilt from silence. Rather, they seek to respond to statements made either by the defendant or defense counsel. So that particular court was saying that, in fact, defense counsel can bind up the defense as well and make post-arrest silence an issue.
Has Davis been followed by any other division of the Court of Appeals in a published opinion?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm unfamiliar whether it has or has not, so I'm sorry, I can't provide an answer to the court on that issue. Furthermore, even if this court were to decide that there's a problem here, if this court were to conduct any kind of analysis for prejudice or harmless error, it would also have to find, in fact, in this case, that there was no prejudice and there was no harmless error. There was also testimony from Trooper Cutler where he said that when the defendant was arrested, he appeared unfazed. He wasn't surprised. He didn't express any fear. He didn't express any anger. He just basically had no expression at all when he was arrested. This is clearly demeanor evidence. Demeanor evidence does not involve any Fifth Amendment issues, and that's been upheld by this U.S. Supreme Court.
Does demeanor evidence make other evidence harmless or render other evidence harmless beyond reasonable doubt?
Well, no, Your Honor, but it's part of basically a puzzle. It's just another piece of evidence that can be used to show the defendant's guilt. The other aspect here is the overwhelming evidence against the defendant as well. Again, we're talking about 51 pounds of marijuana divided into multiple bales that were inside his van. The defendant testified, yes, it's my van. I've been with it since it was in New Mexico. There was also testimony that the troopers found that where the marijuana was concealed in the doors, it had clearly been manipulated. Let's call it even damaged. Now, if Mr. Camacho didn't know anything about the marijuana in the vehicle and saw that his vehicle had been damaged by Mr. Rojo putting it in there, there's a reasonable inference that he would have said something about it. He would have questioned Mr. Rojo about this particular issue. But he didn't. So I think it's, again, another piece of evidence to show that the evidence in this particular case was, in fact, overwhelming. And if Your Honors don't have any further questions, we'd ask that the people would ask that you affirm the decision below.
No, I do have a question. What is your view of Salinas versus Texas? What does that do to this whole perhaps jumbled area of pre-arrest, post-arrest, pre-Miranda, things like that?
Well, Your Honor, it's the people's position that there's been no clear and unambiguous statement from the U.S. Supreme Court that pre-arrest silence cannot be used as substantive evidence. We'd say that Salinas, in fact, supports that particular argument. So based upon that, you know, until we have a clear and unambiguous statement that it cannot be used, then it definitely has some evidentiary value. That's to be determined by the states. Obviously, in Colorado, there's been no statement from the Colorado Supreme Court regarding the issue of pre-arrest silence or post-arrest pre-Miranda silence, anything ambiguous in terms of constitutional dimensions. In terms of evidentiary value, there have been statements made by the courts where post-arrest pre-Miranda silence should only be used for impeachment purposes and if the defendant testifies. But in fact, if it's used and the defendant doesn't testify, that's not automatic reversible error. It's still reviewed for plain error. So in fact, there is some kind of evidentiary value to it as well.
Can you give me the people's position on Welsh 1? In your view, is it still good law in light of Welsh's two, the statements made both by the dissent and that the majority did not embrace the analysis in Welsh 1?
Your Honor, it's at least our position that Welsh 1, on constitutional grounds, is not good law. I mean, the problem being that the Supreme Court explicitly said in Welsh 1, we're not going to decide this on constitutional issues or constitutional bases. And if they say we're not deciding this on constitutional bases, that should at least imply, if not expressly infer, that any type of constitutional analysis below is infirm. If there are no further questions.
Really? We should imply that it's infirm, as opposed to the old adage that, gee, if you can avoid a constitutional issue decided on grounds other than constitutional issues, that's a countervailing principle. That would seem to go against the point that you were just making, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Have you ever heard of the principle that says, decide cases on narrow grounds if you can avoid a constitutional issue decided on narrower grounds? Have you ever heard of that principle?
Yes, Your Honor, I have.
Okay, so why couldn't Welsh 2 be viewed as embracing that principle rather than an implicit infirmity with respect to Welsh 1?
Because I think you have other cases as well that say that it still talks about the ambiguity about the constitutional law on this particular subject. There's other cases out there as well, such as Quintana, that say that the constitutional dimensions of a particular subject have not been determined yet.
And that's true, but Quintana was long before Welsh 1.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So is there other cases since Welsh 2 that suggest that Welsh 1 is infirm?
And, Your Honor, I'm looking at my notes to try to find a case in particular. I don't have one on hand. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And, Your Honor, I'm going to start with that last question because, no, I don't think that there are any cases out there that say that the analysis in Welsh 1 is somehow infirm, because the Supreme Court did not reject the Court of Appeals analysis, they said, you know, we don't have to go there because all of the arguments were made under the rules of evidence, but they didn't say, and the Court of Appeals was wrong, but nevertheless, we are affirming their ruling. I think that if the Supreme Court had specifically disagreed, they could have said so. So I don't think that a constitutional analysis is improper.
But Ms. Rayer, from the trial court's perspective on whether it's obvious, you have Welsh 1 that the majority did not embrace in Welsh 2, and you have two dissenters saying they specifically would have reversed. So how could a trial court look at that and think that that's obviously the law?
Well, I think that they also have Quintana out there, and I think the Quintana, Supreme Court case Quintana, is very much like this one because the defendant didn't testify. He put on his duress defense through a co-defendant, through the person that actually duressed him. And the Supreme Court there did a relevance analysis, so I think it should have been obvious, perhaps, I mean, under Welsh 1, the constitutional, but at least under Welsh 2, under the rules of evidence, I think it should have been obvious to the court that, you know, silence just isn't relevant, and we need to do some analysis. Unfortunately, defense counsel didn't even see it and lodge an objection. But I do think that given Quintana, Welsh 2, and Welsh 1, I think all of those put the court clearly on notice.
Is it your position that the facts of this case closely parallel the facts of Quintana?
Yes. I want to briefly respond to the Attorney General's argument that the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply here because there were no Miranda warnings given. Well, there were Miranda warnings given eventually, and he invoked his right to silence, but I don't think that the presence or absence of Miranda warnings is crucial here. The Fifth Amendment's existed for many more years than the Miranda case. Fifth Amendment right of silence and cases interpreting it before Miranda didn't turn on Miranda. The Attorney General said that, you know, the prosecutor in the case knew the defendant's defense, Mr. Camacho's defense, and yes, you know, he is required under Rule 16 to give a disclosure, and he gave a written disclosure that Mr. Camacho didn't know the evidence was in the van and that he did intend, he endorsed the co-defendant to testify. He did on cross-examine elicit through Mr. Cutler or Officer Cutler that Mr. Rojo took responsibility in court later on, but there was no extensive testimony about exactly what that meant. There was no testimony in the record that he was exclusively the owner, that he never told my client what he was doing. So I think the Supreme Court in Welsh 2 has a huge discussion about what rebuttal evidence is and about how all the timing of this should work. And in order to rebut evidence, you've got to have the other side put on, the adverse party put on evidence first so that there is something to rebut. So there was nothing to rebut here. I don't think opening statement can be, yes.
No, I was just about to ask that. I was going to say, did defense counsel say anything in opening statement, like affirmatively that, you know, defendant did not know?
That was his argument. And in an adversarial system, he is allowed to, you know, rely on the state proving knowledge. Okay.
That's true.
He did.
That's true. But under Davis, wouldn't there be evidence that could be respond to defense counsel's opening statement?
I don't think so, because in the Davis case, defense counsel was arguing specific statements of people that were going to be coming in the record, were going to be litigated. And so what that did is that allowed the prosecutor, when the prosecutor called those witnesses, to address it as part of their case in chief, as opposed to waiting till the end. And defense counsel brought those statements out, so I think that was fair game. However, whether a defendant is going to testify, whether a defendant is going to put on evidence, that's a decision that you make after the prosecutor's case. And I would also argue that I think defense counsel responded to the prosecutor's argument, because the prosecution said, you're going to hear from these informants about how he's done this before, even though the court ruled that that could only come in rebuttal. Thank you. I would ask you to reverse Mr. Camacho's convictions. Thank you,
counsel, for your argument. I want to thank both counsel for their arguments in this case. Case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Court will stand.